Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
You're listening to Scaffold, a podcast featuring interviews with architects, artists, and designers. I'm your host, Matthew Blunderfield. In this episode, I speak with the architects Oliver Lutyens and Thomas Padmanabhan, who formed their practice in Zurich in 2007. Their buildings are beguiling, seemingly composed of the thinnest of planes, so that they appear like a series of super graphics or billboards folded together to make a volume. This flatness is countered by their deep and complex interiors, which often incorporate elements that are just a little bit out of the ordinary. In one project, a terrazzo column casts a shadow of wood laid into the floor, while in another, the doors to a winter garden take on the proportions of a giant window. I met with Oliver and Thomas at Splice Studios in Perseverance Works in Shoreditch, where we talked about, among other things, their fixation with Renaissance architecture and the inspiration they find in it, the illusion of truthful construction in buildings today that are no longer solid, but only ever hollow and layered, and the importance of humor in architecture to bring together not only people, but materials and objects too. And now, here's the interview. I hope you enjoy it. So, when you're teaching and when you're presenting your work, you tend to juxtapose two images of two different types of projects as precedents or references for the work you're doing. And typically you'll choose a project from the past and from a specific moment in the past, the Renaissance. And you'll pick a project from the 20th century as well, and generally between the 30s and 60s. So there's specific time periods that seem important to you both. Mm-hmm. And like you've explained this in the past as a kind of useful friction that a contemporary project can come out of. And I'm just wondering why the Renaissance in particular, and what are you looking for when you look at projects from this era?
Well, the Renaissance was a very brief period in which architects were doing fantastic singular project based on very limited knowledge of the past, say of antiquity. The projects were usually inserted into the medieval fabric of existing cities. They were often left unfinished. There were fragments. They were working with the mostly, especially in the normal house buildings, with the construction methods of the time. Yet they were developing a new language of architecture. So the fragmentary, the unfinished, the partially powerlessness of the actors, of the architects, we feel very close to that, and we recognize our own time there. At the same time, it was the Renaissance was a self-conscious attempt to reconstruct architecture as a language. We're not interested in the Renaissance as the beginning of a new classicist tradition. We're not interested in it as an idealized historic epoch, like it was seen in the 19th century. Mm. But we are interested in the individual achievements of very different characters and architects. And there we have a preference for those who have who see the limits of their own work, rather than striving for complete harmony and balance. Say, we prefer Giulio Romano to his teacher Raphael. We prefer Michelangelo to the San Gallos.
Or Alberti to Bramante.
Mm-hmm. So there's a we feel that the connection is also that Renaissance Palazzo, for example, is usually a very normal masonry construction with a series of outer layers of render or of natural stone that provide the architecture that is visible. So there's a layering of things in the construction, and we have to face the same problem today as we have increasingly layered construction that have a more complicated, where the idea of architecture truth is more complicated than in a modernist attempt to create a direct connection between constructive structure, spatial structure, and expression, which was very strong in our teachers or in the generation that came before us in Swiss architecture.
There's this line that you always seem to start with when you give lectures,
mm-hmm.
that I'm tempted to read back to you now. It's about a particular dilemma that has to do more with regions between the urban and rural, but I think it could actually apply to a question about a dilemma between the past and the present. So I'm just going to read it, and then mm-hmm. I'd kind of like to talk about it for a bit. So I think every lecture I've seen of yours online, this is how it begins. Our work starts with a dilemma. We love the city. We love streets, facades, squares, and rich, complex interiors. We love refined architecture. We love urban architecture. We love history, continuity, and time in architecture. Paradoxically, when we design buildings, we almost always end up in situations that are never clearly urban or rural, but blurry and fragmented and undefined in between. And I think that just from looking at the projects you guys have done, there's a lot to relish about being in between in architecture. And not only in terms of being in between urbanity and the rural, but in between a kind of frame of mind that's backwards looking and forwards looking. And I think this kind of ties back to the Renaissance question. What would be good to talk about is like where this fascination originated from.
From the Renaissance.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's quite different with the two of us. Thomas can maybe explain better his situations, but I'm somebody who comes from the present, and through architects that I like, go back into the past. So for me, it was, I think my first true love in architecture was the work of Alvaro Siza. And I kind of understood that he's doing a contemporary architecture, but that addresses a much broader field. It's addressed the Portuguese tradition, it addressed classical architecture, and when he travels and builds a house in Holland, it looks like a Dutch building, even though it's an Alvaro Siza building. Plus, he has an extremely interesting formal way of making things that appealed to me a lot. And through Siza, I came to Venturi, and from Venturi, there was kind of an opening up to the architecture from 500 years ago, Mannerist architecture, Renaissance architecture, Baroque architecture, whatever. And because that's what he writes about, essentially, in Complexity and Contradiction, and he doesn't look at it as a historian, but he looks at it as a contemporary architect, in being interested in formal ideas, formal problems, in energy appearing in buildings, and tries to make that valid again in his contemporary architecture, and I think that's it's an incredible statement and achievement what Venturi did. No, this directness that you can look at anything and make it yours by trying to be to make something that is as good as those examples that you really like.
Mm.
So for me it's a completely intuitive and for both of us, no, it was a completely intuitive thing to work with Renaissance examples, because we looked at the facade of, say, the Palazzo Borromeo of Pier Ligorio, and we said, wow, look, it's a central line, it's a division, horizontal division, 1-to-1, there's a central motif, and this cross, that's something we can still do today. Of course, we have different means, mm-hmm. but we can work with the same content.
I guess what I'm interested in is, like, how you look at buildings, because there is such a hunger and desire for the contemporary, obviously, for obvious reasons, and especially amongst young architects, generally when precedents are dug out, they're of the recent past or of the very near present. It tends to be the case that architects shy away from looking too far back, because there might be a prescribed way of reading historical buildings, or an institutionalized way of understanding historical buildings that just doesn't appeal. But what I'm learning from hearing you now and having listened to some of your previous lectures is that there's all kinds of new potential for revisiting historical precedents. And so, Thomas, I know you studied under Jan Pieper,
mm-hmm.
And you were researching Renaissance architecture while in school. And so you probably have a kind of formal training in how to read and make sense of these types of buildings. Whereas Oliver, on the other hand, I know that you were...
But it's not entirely true, because it's funny that you bring this up. I studied in Germany in Aachen, and the reason why Jan Pieper became my most important teacher, he didn't teach studio, but he taught history, architectural history, was because there was a complete lack of other meaningful teachers, you know? It was a complete void, you know.
Uh-huh.
So it was the time when Germany took up some of the British high tech and copied it in a kind of not very convincing way. So Jan Pieper, he came from the anthropological side of the kind of 70s, and applied the anthropological view of city ritual, the idea of the city as a theatrical scene, onto his analysis of Renaissance architecture and urbanism. And the richness of experience and just the claim of how much of culture and thought can go into architecture, that served as an example, while his way of perceiving architecture, I felt, looking back, seems to me now much more linked to literature, to narrative,
mm-hmm.
than to direct perception of, say, proportion and gestalt. And for me, it was like a typical relation to a teacher, where the teacher suggests something, or I read in his work that he suggests that what if today's architecture could be as rich as an experience as the Renaissance architecture. No? That was the claim, and a promise that I could never fulfill or find in my student work or in the teaching, but it just stood there. Well, then I decided to spend a year in Rome at the La Sapienza to study. I had the chance to see a lot of the work that we are interested in now, and it somehow filtered into my memory, as a raw material. I would say rather as a raw material that becomes almost like a quarry from which I take blocks, you know, and rework them, because our way of looking at say Renaissance architecture, also other architects we are interested in, was hugely informed not by by problems of design in our work. It was hard work. It was not we didn't start off with an ideological judgment about it. Of course, we love it. We love the stuff. But it was when we ask ourselves question of, so how do you relate a two-story building? How do you relate the two levels to one another? And of course, Renaissance palazzi, where they were asking that question all the time, how do you do the number two? How do you do the number three in terms of stories? That was one of the fundamental questions. So then you look at the stuff. But it was only through the work that a new reading was possible, because the work was, the questions came out of the work. That's so it's completely opposite to a kind of 19th century education, a Beaux-Arts education, where you would have all the stuff like an alphabet in front of you, and you were asked to learn the alphabet. But for us. Also, we are always perplexed to give reasons why we love the Renaissance so much, because actually we even have a very selective view of the Renaissance. There are a lot of buildings that we never speak about, you know, because they don't tell us anything, but there are others that we constantly speak about, and it literally never stops, because they have an incredible depth, and they give answers to the most unexpected questions, you know. And it's as if the same building gives an answer to that question, and another question, and a different question. So there's a kind of common learning process that only started when we were working together, and that takes sources and interests from before, but now they are overlaid to an extent that when I see my notes from my studies in Rome, I only recall that I've seen the place. But today the same building has a completely different meaning to me.
It's also quite funny in the relation how we work together that we almost always agree on what's good and what's bad. You know, there's very little architects that Thomas adores and I think they're rubbish. I think there's almost none, and so whenever we show us something, we get kind of equally excited, and that's, I guess, quite special and a very lucky coincidence. No?
Yeah.
I think it's worth actually to step back for a moment and get a picture of your biographies. I know that there's been a great conversation you had with Andrew Clancy on the Register podcast a couple of years ago. And you covered some ground there in terms of talking about your roots into architecture. But there are some points that I wanted to pick up on. And I guess maybe, Oliver, starting with you, I know that you were a graffiti artist for 10 years before going into architecture, at the suggestion of your girlfriend's mom.
Yes.
But I think from the outside, people might scratch their heads at how those two disciplines equate. And I think it has something to do with passion.
It has to do with passion, yes. I mean, for me, it was just a passion. It's something I stumbled upon, got really excited about, the idea that your name is visible everywhere in the city. Then I got really excited about formal problems in graffiti, because it's, you take normal letters and you distort them and you create energy, and so it's not unlike mannerist architecture or work in a way. This ideas of distortion, blowing up stuff, working with scales, but it's also it gave me an incredible reading of the city. Because, you know, if you place a tag somewhere, you know exactly if this corner is prominent or not, how this surface relates to something else, to the shop that's next door, or to the, I don't know, it's the visibility from a certain angle and things like that. That's all the kind of stuff you think about when you do graffiti, or when you just walk through the city and look at that. You know? And it's also a kind of quite typological thing, graffiti. It's you know, this developed into certain types how you do it, and so there's limits and restraints, and there's also restraints in terms of your body size or where you can climb and things like that, but for me it was something that I just really really loved, and I just knew if ever I want to be happy in a job. I need to find something that is similar to that. And I didn't quite know what that would be. I was also interested in film or music. But then I started studying architecture, and immediately I understood that this is it. And I immediately understood that it goes much, much deeper, and it's much, much bigger than graffiti. And so, yeah, within kind of a year, I shifted, and I just completely got hooked on architecture.
And then, Thomas, for you, you started by studying industrial design.
That's true, yeah. I was always drawing from earliest childhood on. I never stopped drawing. I spent my adolescent years in the basement of my parents' house drawing, you know, instead of meeting people, which I really enjoyed. And I tried painting. I realized I was always pushed back to the line. And from there, I went into industrial design because my father is an engineer, and so he had designer friends, so it kind of made sense. But in a year into my studies at Kassel, realized that friends who studied architecture were dealing with questions that for me felt much more profound. They were reaching deeper into history. They were reaching deeper into human experience of the city. The city and history, these two themes, they were so important for me from the beginning. And in Germany, industrial design is very much rooted in the industrial history of the country. It starts with Peter Behrens and AEG. And so it has a very, I would say, clearer limits in industrial production than in other countries, say Italy. So from there, and then I stopped and I started architecture, and it was very clear that was much better for me.
And then you both met working for Diener and Diener, but Oliver, you'd worked for Mealy Peter as well as OMA in Rotterdam. And then Thomas, you, in addition to studying, you said Aachen University, you were in Cornell for a year?
I was in Cornell for 2 years for to two do years. Masters. Yeah.
And then you worked at SOM for a year.
That's right, yeah.
And this was all before Diener and Diener? Or did that happen after?
For me it was before Diener and Diener. I after I finished my studies in Aachen, I went to Cornell and from there to SOM, and then I returned to Europe, and I went directly to Switzerland because I had worked at SOM, that was before during the dot-com boom, on a large number of high-rise buildings in a very short time, while my friends who were already in Switzerland told me about the incredible meticulous detail work they were doing on really very refined projects. So I was sure that I would rather belong in that world than into the commercial world of SOM.
And I guess OMA, to a certain extent, Oliver kind of brought you into the commercial world of architecture. Is that not the case?
I didn't go for that reason.
No, I know. But in terms of like what you were exposed to in these like formative years leading up to the establishment of your own practice.
For me, it was the reason why I went to OMA was different. I worked after my last semester in the ETH. My assistant, she was actually working for Diener and Diener, and she was the HR person for Diener. And she said, "Don't you want to work for us for an internship before the diploma?" And she put me to Berlin, to the Diener office in Berlin, and that was an amazing time for me. And it was the first time that I worked in an architectural practice where I actually saw all the struggles that I had while studying. For instance, the problem of doubt and uncertainty, being kind of brought into the center of the discussions about the design and being part of the project in the end. And I thought that was just so amazing. And then there was Berlin as a city that was a bit different than Berlin of today.
Mm.
And I thought I just want to go back to Berlin to work for that office. Again, it was also a young woman leading the office, Therese Erngard, who was just amazing. And it was the ambition to show the old guys in Basel that the Berlin office was much cooler and funkier. And so that was really, really a pleasure to work there. It didn't happen because I didn't have enough work, so I went to the office in Basel. Then got later work for Miley Payton, and after 4 years in Switzerland, I just needed to get away. And so therefore, there was a decision, and Thomas and I started doing competitions while I was at Miley Payton, and he's in his last year at Diener, and we kind of had this discussion, let's form an office, and I said yes, but I just really need to go 1 year out. I need a year out to go somewhere else. And I loved English architecture at the time. We were looking a lot at English architecture. I thought, so Tony Fretton, Surchison Bates, Caruso St. John. But then I thought, yeah, but it's kind of rather similar to what I would have experienced at Diener.
Mm.
So, and then I thought, okay, let's try Kuhlhaas, because I was always fascinated by Kuhlhaas. And so I went there, and it was also kind of, you know, playing Champions League once in the big stadiums at night, and having the jet set life and flying like very, very tired to Qatar and have kind of crazy meetings and fly back and things like that.
Mm.
It was good for a year, but I had it, you know,
and
it was good that I had an escape plan. And
The funny thing is that I think for us, Oma and Kuhlhaas is a very important point of reference in our discussion, and we, for us, it's Kuhlhaas is one of the greatest architects living. While we have both a fascination for America, and for American architecture, say also of the type of SOM, but obviously not of the SOM that I have experienced. But it was it's a projection of the classical great phase of SOM of Gordon Bunshaft, for example. So we almost anonymous greatness of American architecture we feel hugely attracted to. And so it was going to SOM was it was an experience of being in this enormous office with so many people that worked like a machine, and that was fascinating. Yet there was a big gap between, architecturally speaking, between what was being designed there and what I was working on and what I imagined what SOM should be like or could be or has been. So yet it was, for me, it was so important to be at SOM because it completely eliminated all the fear and respect for big projects, because it's and also the it made everything relative. You know, I know that there can be, you can have a more architecture in a bathroom extension than in a city with 2 million. You know, because it's about the intensity of the work, the ideas that go into it.
And while Diener and Diener is really architecture about the city, and we both share this passion and to understand your work in a kind of part of a cultural idea and being part of public space and that you can make a contribution to what's around. And that that's also, it's kind of what is around is in the center of your project. And Kuhlhaas, we feel, is you know, it's, a lot of people would disagree, but for us it was a kind of modern idea of making an architecture that's part of the city, where the idea of urban life is in the center of his project. So. And therefore,
and while we feel that in some of Roger Diener's project, the problematic nature of the fragmented city of today is being addressed, but even more so in Kuhlhaas' project, the contradictions of the modern age, between capitalism and social ideas, the city, the question of scales and money, they all involved. So this openness of and this fragmentary nature of our situation, we are really interested in that in Kuhlhaas' work, because we feel that architecture is not about just making peace with the situation or solving things, pacifying conflicts, but also to articulate them.
And to some extent, to agitate or not?
To be...
Sure, agitate. Maybe, yeah, it's about energy, you know? Mm-hmm. I think good architecture always exudes an incredible energy, and mm-hmm. sometimes it's a bit more about being calm, and sometimes it's mm-hmm. it's much more invigorating.
I think when I said agitate, I was thinking of like what good fiction tends to do, which is to reflect a contemporary condition back to its audience, but in a way that you always felt but could never articulate.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a kind of uncanniness there, or a surprise, that is at its heart a little bit disturbing
mm-hmm.
and a little bit uncomfortable, but totally curious and intriguing. And it makes you want to look even closer.
Mm-hmm.
And I think for me, the aspect of your architecture that makes me want to do that the most are your facades. And I wonder if we could talk a bit about facades for a second, and why they've gained so much importance in the way that you design and talk about your buildings.
We saw in our work that the facade, if we are in a situation where urbanism, the job of doing urbanism is given to the singular building, in a way. That something that is in London here, that is already almost completely the case, while in Switzerland that is increasingly the case. So if the building has to do the job to give beauty, public space, to create an idea of the city, then it's the facade's job to do that, and to create a sense of urbanity, and not just on a functional level. We don't talk about ground floor uses, but on a level of expression and language. And we feel that the language, the aspect of architecture as a formal language, has been overlooked in Swiss German architecture for a long time, because the question of language has been an attempt of to tie the aspect of language together with plan and typology into a stable entity,
mm-hmm.
Kind of unity. And we embrace the fact that unity has become is increasingly lost, and that the building becomes more of an artifact that is composed of pieces and aspects and planes, and literally planes that mm-hmm. put it together.
What's also interesting is the relation of the facade. I mean, it's a kind of conflict situation, the facade, no? It's a very thin layer, and it deals with a large scale on the outside, with public space, with certain formal ideas or aspects, but it also deals on the inside with use, with also formal aspects, and those usually don't really relate, you know, especially not if you have an apartment building and there's just a kind of normal bedroom behind a certain type of window, but on the outside this window has to provide for something else.
Mm.
And it was so great yesterday to see The Red House by Tony Fretton, because we've been looking at this building for a long, long time since it's been published. And then, you know, it has a symmetrical three-bay facade with a central bay sticking out with a very tall central window. And then from the planet section, we would understand that on its inside it has this huge studio space, salon space. I don't know how he calls it, but it's this
This hall, yeah.
But there's a special name for it. It's a very, very big space that is on kind of two-story high. Then you're inside. The bay window is asymmetrically to that space, and the central window is also asymmetrical. So it's a totally informal and rather relaxed way how this huge and formally very important space relates to this bay window and the centrality of the facade. And that was like a real unexpected revelation, and it was really nice because it kind of took also away the weight of that space, that it doesn't have a central axis and things, but it's in itself a huge space with some carefully positioned windows, but it doesn't work in an actual relationship. But for the outside of the building, the actual relationship is important. And yeah, that's in our building on Herrenstraße, for instance. We also have a central bay window. But even the rooms that are in this window, they also have the corner of the bay within the space, and that gives a beautiful second or even third scale within that one room. It's not only that you can look in the street space, but also this kind of the facade and the room, they have a almost like a communication together.
And if one, in the case of Tony Fratton's Red House, if you wouldn't have had that independent idea of that facade, he wouldn't have a almost a counterpart for the inside to work with. So you need a kind of semi-autonomy of the facade as a starting point to develop these tensions. So that's so interesting. So that's going completely against the notion of a facade being the result of a projection of needs from inside to the outside, but it's about discovering that a facade has formal rules of its own, that once you're entering that conversation on the facade, you're not free anymore as a designer, but you're entering a set of dependencies where the facade says, okay, I have my own will.
And this is how you design literally as well, it sounds like, where the facade on a model, usually at 1 to 50, is studied and iterated almost independent of the plan in some cases.
Yes.
And that you will detach and readhere different versions of the facade. Well, maybe the plan is being worked out as its own problem.
Yes. We have a very intuitive way of working on the plan and of the facade. And we have a very linear way. We don't do options, we just go one way. And so we're in constant discussion. And so if there is a good idea in the facade, it usually has a formal strength somehow, and it comes in conflict with what is the design of the plan at that moment, and out of that, there's something is developing. No, so it's an operation that is ongoing, and sometimes to design the plan, especially in Swiss housing, where the surfaces and the relation of rooms and the size of things are very very clearly defined, takes a very very long time. So usually when we start with the facade to really design it, apart from having ideas, the plan is already quite developed, but that doesn't make it less independent in a way. So just, yeah.
And our experience was increasingly that that when you have a contradiction between, say, the plan and the facade, that there will be a way to solve it.
Yeah.
Now, we are extremely optimistic about it, and there will be a way to be stubborn both about the facade and about the plan, because we are not architects who tell the client, oh, we needed to move that room because of the facade, because that would not help us, because we live in a world where the facade, the plan, nobody cares about the facades, and the plan is everything. But it was interesting that sometimes you need to do only have very very minute, very little operations to reconcile them, yeah? To bring them together, and they can. It's not don't have to think them together from the beginning. So we're kind of relaxed about it for a long time, and we are extremely optimistic that things will come together in the end. Our urge to impose control over the totality is becoming less and less with our work.
Urban context that would kind of tell us how we should design the facade. There was also no more the constructive context, say the you know Swiss architecture 10 or 15 or 20 years ago, for instance monolithic concrete construction, colored concrete, things like that. It was just to us it was not available because our projects that we started with were under quite an impressive cost. How do you say cost?
Pressure,
yeah. And so for the first building we had to build, it was clear we had to do outer insulation and stucco. And that was something that very little contemporary architects tried. There was Peter Megli did one, even with plastic windows, which was quite interesting. But a lot of the others, they tried to be very abstract about that, and they were a bit ashamed, and it was kind of seen as not correct to do it and not being constructed enough or real material, and it comes also of course from problems that could happen, and you need to maybe in 20 years those insulations are gone, you need to redo
it. It was seen as a decline of architectural quality.
Yeah,
because when the building physic decided that we would not have 12 centimeters of insulation but 25 or 28, then a massive construction with a massive outer layer and inner layer would be impossible from a certain point on. So what's the how do you deal with that cheapening of the building, with that loss of where the value of also the architectural significance of the building at the time was based on monolithic weight and closed form, a lack of open joints, a kind of illusion of truthful construction, and we when we discovered through that work with the outer insulation that when we liberate ourselves from that dogma, we can open up towards all kinds of more complex ideas of the relationship between construction and truth, layered construction, open forms, where you're self-conscious about the hollowness of the layered facade. That was a liberation, and I think that has opened up a kind of an ongoing interest in all forms of layerings and skins.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that I guess just to kind of break down this dichotomy between this illusion of authenticity that's apparently achieved through creating buildings that look solid, but in fact can't be anymore because of technical, environmental, and economic constraints, versus creating buildings that are apparently almost paper thin or have outer skins that are as hollow as eggshells.
Mm.
I think architects begrudgingly move in that direction. Very rarely do they embrace it, and very rarely do they see the potential and opportunity to exploit the cheapness of contemporary materials and the thinness and malleability of them as well.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like generally architects would feel like they'd failed if they had to resort to that. And yet you seem to be embracing it wholeheartedly, and finding all kinds of new potentials in there. And I think the main potential that's most exciting to me is this idea, not of tectonics as we know it, but of what you've termed a visual tectonics. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit more about what that means to you.
I want to go one step back.
Sure.
Because building with cheap materials or with construction, with joints and things like that, doesn't mean that you embrace, say, a kind of trashy way to do architecture. I had this discussion with a friend who's the same age as us, but I would say a generation ahead. Before. And she thought that our building at Herrenstrasse was actually the trashy way of making a facade. But I mean, that facade cost us so much time to design and construct, and it's not relying on a system that somebody sells you and you just kind of glue it on the building.
Oh, it's bespoke.
It's bespoke, and it's like when you go to Savile Row, you know, you get the finest stuff, and every joint is very carefully judged and fought for, no?
Mm.
Whereas she built a building that they glued very thick ceramic tiles on it, and in my opinion, that's like really trashy, because you see the silicon joints and you see all kinds of shit, and it looks really, really bad. But for the old generation, this is still valid outer shell, because it's ceramic tiles that are glued on the facade. So therefore, yes, it's also not the kind of, you know, cheapness of cool husk sometimes with working with spruce board or I don't know what, you know, and kind of transforming it into something else. I think it's tailor-made stuff, but with different materials, it's something else, and it costs us a lot of work and energy.
Mm-hmm.
So, but now I forgot your question.
The visual tectonics.
The visual tectonics.
Looking at looking at, for example, the Renaissance, when one asks oneself what tectonics means, there are different answers. One of the answers where the tectonics is seen through a kind of the eyes of the mechanical age is one of a gravitational tectonic, where things are stacked. Elements are physically attached to one another to defy gravity and to move up towards the sky. But if you look at a lot of, most of the architecture of, say, of Europe is masonry architecture. And you have large walls with windows, and you have architectural elements that give a structure and gestalt and a form to the facade. And
that's essentially Roman architecture, no?
Yeah, and very, very seldom do you really need a kind of the full alphabet of the conventional classical language that has to be done on the facade. For example, somebody like Palladio, who did villas also with budgets that were quite limited, did enormous, beautiful render walls with a minimum of architectural elements in natural stone that sometimes float, they imply a tectonic where the forms, they come together in the eye of the beholder, and they create centers, they create centralities, they create edges, they provide an understanding of how this facade wants to be read from the top to the bottom, from the center to the periphery, from the periphery to the center, from the lower part to the upper part, and so on, or from the left to the right. And so this this reading, this the capacity to read architecture with the eye, is a necessary ability to read the architecture, the European architecture in general. So the visual tectonic is not not a new thing. It's not something we claim for ourselves, but we think that it's as the tectonic that is weight-based is actually a very limited view of tectonics. Huh? Because we also think that the Greek temples are not about weight. Huh? The conflict, the tension becomes the strongest. Yeah?
Mm.
The idea of weight is always suppressed in classical architecture, with flowers and organic forms and so on. Huh? In the capitals.
And even the work of Hans Kolhoff, you know, it's not necessarily about weight, because this stone-clad facade, it's more about how pieces overlap with each other and kind of make a visual solidity, but you can still feel that it's not a massive stone construction. You've in those early projects in Berlin where he makes very tectonic facades, he calls them tectonic facades, they're skins.
And it's but the question of weight is really interesting, and being here in London to speak about this subject, because when you look at a lot of the architecture in London that has been inspired by, say, Palladio, if you look at the Chiswick House, and I've seen it 3 years ago, I saw it for the first time, it's a paper thin model. It has a specific weight that's a third of a Palladian villa. Huh? Mm-hmm. Yet it's architecture, it works, and it's adapted to the gentleness of the English situation,
mm-hmm.
Of the landscape, of the climate, of the green, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Of the country that is protected and that for a long time was able to live without city walls.
Mm.
We have a series of projects that float.
Yes.
And we discovered that first, I think, in a project for a town hall, where we had a central space and it was really dividing two masses, a bit like a hamburger, two masses and in a floating condition. And we realized we can do that with lines and things like that. So for our last building we just finished, the house on Waldmeisterweg uses also this central line. And even that, I would say, is still tectonic architecture, in the sense that it's there's this book by Hans Sedlmayr where he speaks about the loss of the center. And it's a bit problematic because he has a real problem with modernity. But he says there, he speaks about Boulez, and he's annoyed by the spherical rooms and forms by Boulez, because he says this does not recognize earth as a basis for architecture anymore. Sedlmayr says everything that recognizes earth or the surface of ground as the basis is still a tectonic architecture. And so therefore, if you have something that floats or hovers over a horizontal surface, in our view, that's still tectonic.
Mm-hmm.
And no. I think that's
And then also we think that when we look at contemporary or at modern art, art is always also a kind of teacher for architecture to think about formal relationships, and so the explorations and the knowledge of contemporary and modern art informs also our capacity to see relationships in architecture, and so that is also so architecture is somehow not isolated from the other arts, but we think that that's part of the same experience, and often art in our eyes is a bit more advanced, and is teaching us things, and we as architects are really slow. And we have to drag along with us many things like bathrooms and so on, and toilets that we have to make work inside our buildings. So maybe it takes us a few more decades to bring artistic experience into architecture.
To what extent do you see yourselves as working in an art practice or as artists? I'm thinking of the way, for example, in one of your projects, you've built a hollow column,
mm.
because of how it contributes to the room it's in and how it delineates the space, not because it's holding anything up.
Mm.
And it's quite a beautiful terrazzo column.
That one is out of stone. It's clad in stone.
Clad in stone.
Yeah.
And then the stone, the hollow stone column, is casting a fake wood shadow across the floor.
No, that's a different that's project.
So I'm thinking of okay.
Yeah, the one that's casting the shadow is load bearing.
Okay.
Because only load bearing columns can cast a shadow.
Well, in any case, though, let's separate the two. You have a real column made out of terrazzo casting a fake shadow made out of wood in the ground. And then in other projects, you have hollow columns, which are serving a different purpose that has to do with defining the space in the interior. But also, they become sculptural elements in their own right to a certain degree. And I feel like decisions like that might often be made by someone who thinks like an artist, or who thinks like a trickster, or who thinks like someone who wants to make a problem out of the way we think about living and about building.
No, we don't see ourselves in this kind of league of being an artist or something. Mm. I think it's you know, architecture history is full of columns that don't support anything. And I don't know
that serve a visual or a spatial purpose.
Yeah. Mm. And I don't know, in English, in German you would say eine Stütze for something that is load bearing, and it would be defined by an engineer its size, no?
Maybe a post in English? Is that a thing, a square or rectangular volume that's holding up a ceiling?
Sure, yeah.
But then if it's a rectangular volume, if you call it a pillar, Pfeiler in German, it's an architectural element.
Mm-hmm.
And the proportion of the pillar is defined by architectural needs and not by structural needs. And we speak almost entirely, except when we design the parking garage, we speak about pillars. And it's only in the parking garage where we actually have Stützen.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, it's just,
So it's not. We are earnest and sincere about it, and not. We just we say this with a hollow, the hollowness we underline is because it's always very nice to make some of our colleagues nervous, you know, about that, you know, that we enjoy that very much.
Maybe it's wrong me to fixate too much on hollow columns, because of course there, as you say, many hollow columns in architecture and architectural history. There are other things too that make me that pique my curiosity and make me wonder how you define the role you're playing as an architect versus that of someone like an artist. So for example, in one project, the way you enter the building is by whispering into the ear of a metal cat. You have to ring first. and I think it's in the same project, in the communal circulation area. There are these giant fasteners holding up the glass plates that form the balustrade.
Yeah.
Similarly, the windows out onto a winter garden look like doors.
Mm-hmm.
They're the scale of a door.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the way you photograph your projects, I didn't realize this, but you handmade fake cardboard furniture to populate the interiors of your buildings.
Yes.
In some instances. In others, you'd fill a large room with just a guitar standing upright or something.
Yeah.
And there's this kind of interest in, I think, upending certain expectations about what we think about when we look at architecture. And I tell myself this is what a trickster would do, and to a certain extent, all artists are tricksters. And so that's maybe where the question came from.
But in those two cases, the problem was very practical. If you have a photographer photograph your building, and it's about housing or apartments, then do you have it get the photographs of the empty apartment, or do you get a sense of inhabitation? Because this space, empty space, is very difficult to read as such for the eye in photographs. So in the first case of the cardboard furniture, we were working, in both cases, we were working with a Swiss photographer, Walter Meyer, and we felt that it was not good to bring in real furniture from the furniture store.
Because it was actually all his idea. It was his idea, no? He wanted furnished apartments, and he said it's tacky to rent stuff.
Yeah,
he said, can't you build models, no?
Yeah.
Because he liked our models.
Yeah.
And Thomas actually builds all our models most of the time, and with a bit of help of other people. And correct me, but I thought it was entirely Walter's idea. Also, the way they would be made somehow. And you went to his...
I went to his studio and I built them every evening. I went there for a couple of weeks.
And he had books, you know, that, because we thought about abstract furniture, but he had books and he was very precise, a stool by Lowe's and
I started out building a generic table. That what I thought was a generic table, like a... And he looked at it and he said, oh, that's a bit boorish. And then I said, okay, please tell me what to do, you know? So then he pulled out this large collection of books on traditional classical furniture. So from which he selected the ones I should build. So there was an English chair from the early 1800s. There was a lot of Biedermeier from Austria and Germany. There was the Lowe's, the Egyptian Lowe's stool. There was a table from... owned by Thomas Jefferson, mostly classical stuff. And so this populated the space. And so it was a bit like a zombie, you know. It was these cardboard furniture, they have a presence, yet they are not really there. And they're
much friendlier than a zombie.
Yeah.
Because they also, their color was amazing, how the color of those furnitures, this kind of brownish corrugated cardboard, how that relates to the colors of the interiors. It was really fantastic. Yeah.
And then when we did the other building in the Herrenstraßen building, we had the same problem. At first, we wanted to have real people inside the apartments. And we cast a series of people, and they came, and Walter took photographs, but it was completely unsuccessful, because they were so specific, these people, and they were sucking the energy out of the space. So instead of having people to do certain things, we thought we had props, like theater props, that would indicate or talk about inhabitation and use, so that there would be the guitar, there would be the umbrella, the steam cooker, the what else, some other elements that would somehow, or the walking stick, that would somehow speak about the absence of a person who may have been just there.
It just strikes me that the degree of care with which you approach the construction of the image of your projects is quite uncommon. And maybe it's not the work of an artist per se, but it certainly isn't what you'd expect an architect to do when they document their work.
I spoke with Stephen Bates about this yesterday, and it's a problem that we have with the last building we did, which is this house on Waldmeisterweg, where we have this narrative that it could be like a beach house in this green and leafy area of the city. But when Hélène Binet came to photograph it, it was end of November, very grey weather in Zurich, there was fog on the first day, and which actually resulted in a beautiful series of images. But if you want to tell a developer that, yo, this house has the lightness and the joy of a beach house, he will not see it, you know. He will see a cold, austere, very formal architecture. And so, yeah, sometimes, you know, you just, maybe we have to re-photograph it for that documentation or selling reasons of a building. But that set that Hélène made is still amazing to us, because to us it's, when we finish the project, we kind of leave it aside, and all the energy you put in, all the struggle, it kind of goes. No? And also all the ideas, you kind of did them, and they're gone for a while, and maybe some come back in a different phase, but it's it's kind of interesting how when you haven't built them, you kind of constantly reuse similar ideas and test them out, and when you've worked through them and you've constructed them and you've seen them, they kind of, they're on their own and they're not so important anymore, and new ideas appear. But still, for us, it's the photographs that we get from those buildings is a way to revisit those buildings. And most of the time, I like the images much better than the actual building. I'm always a bit worried when I go back, because the Hellerstrasse is next to the football field, and I always go to the games when Zurich plays, and I always walk by the building, but I'm always a bit anxious, you know. How does it look? Is there a problem? How do people react? And with the images, I never have that problem, because that's kind of a very safe and also a distant way to see them. It's not our way to see them, but somebody else's. And that opens up qualities that we did not expect. And it's a bit similar when somebody writes about your work. He brings in aspects and ideas you would have never thought of, or he sees things you never thought of. And that's very rewarding in a way, that something one does triggers things in other people and that come back to you.
I think hopefully we'll just continue to go until someone barges in, because I really want to, there's a few more quick questions I want to ask. One reference that comes up again and again, when you talk about your projects, and it's Michelangelo's Laurentian Library, where, for listeners who aren't familiar with the project, it's a room with a very grand and considered and like apparently constructed interior. But when we look at a plan detail of it, we see that these columns are pushed into a wall that's almost paper thin, and that there's so much work being done to achieve a certain effect in the interior that in fact has more to do with a sleight of hand or a certain kind of magic. And that's different from construction. And so you have this kind of dichotomy of architecture versus construction. And there's a kind of strangeness, I think, in that comparison. Why is architecture distinct from construction to you?
Today's construction methods don't contain an architectural culture. So the construction methods of today need an opposite, a will, an idea, of what could be done with them. So when we design and we try to find the expression of a facade, often we consciously refuse to decide on the materiality for quite a long time while designing it, so that the discussion centers on proportion and structure and relief and form, rather than on materiality. So then when the materiality comes into play, then the materiality gives us a kind of resistance, because we have to construct it. And we really, really enjoy that resistance between the formal will and the materiality, which doesn't mean that we are working against the material when we construct it, but but we can be very clear in our internal discussion when we go with the logic of the material and when we break the logic of that material.
I think just as a way to wrap up now, part of the richness of that visual experience has to do with the inherent humor, I think, in a lot of the work that you do. And there's a lot of talk about, you know, historical reference in relation to the postmodernist tradition and the specific type of humor embedded in that, which is one of irony. And this kind of plays out across mediums, from literature to art to architecture. And I know that you've asserted over and over again that yours is not an ironic architecture, but it's a certain type of humor that you use a cultural association to try and unpack. And you talk about like speech and language in German and the way that seriousness is conveyed with a serious tone, whereas in the kind of English tradition, seriousness can come through the lightest and most humorous tone. And in fact, sometimes the more serious something is, the funnier it comes across. Could you talk a little bit more about, I guess, first the idea of humor in your work, and then the specific cultural association you've made and how you align yourself at once with a kind of Swiss tradition and then something that maybe is more other?
I think there's two aspects to the humor question. The reason why we don't like irony, or why we think it's problematic in postmodern architecture, irony is claiming to be serious, and the seriousness conceals a joke. No? I think that was Schopenhauer, no? Whereas humor is using a joke to say something very serious. No? And our work is very, very serious, but we also enjoy doing it. And you know, we talk a lot about it, and also with the studio, and we have pleasure in doing things. It's, architecture is such a generous profession, you know, we give, and we can create things that are unexpected and that are delightful. And so this joy we experience, it kind of comes into the work, and humor is a part of that.
And you know, the humor is fundamentally inclusive. Humor takes your opposite into your own realm, includes him or her, while irony is creating a border, is excluding the other person.
Mm.
We've stumbled across an interesting writing by Arnold Hauser on mannerism, in which he linked the mannerist angst of the 15th century to the emergence of humor, where humor in his view is a sign of being emphatic about the helplessness of the human situation, and the kind of the lost individual in a tragic situation, while sarcasm or irony exists before that, before mannerism, as a way of just putting somebody down, you know, creating a distance. So that probably irony can be seen as part of a humanist idea.
The thing about with the tone, I think it's very important, because if you create something like symmetry or kind of classical aspects in a building, but you're in a really everyday agglomeration situation where left and right the buildings don't look so great and are not glamorous and don't have a certain
ambition.
Yeah, ambition. It's toning it down, making it thin, making it light, making it humorous, is a way of totally including all these crappy buildings next and right. They're not a problem, you know. It's when you meet people, it's also, you know, you try to be open at first and you know, not always show your back and think you're something better than others. And even if some people may be stronger and lead forward somewhere, it's better to take everyone with you instead of having everyone against you.
And that question of including things goes into the materiality, physicality of things. I mean, the TV screens and all the aspects of consumerism, they should be comfortable in our houses. We don't want to create an exclusive environment in which everything that's not precious and beautiful, it looks terrible. We have to include the normality, and if plastic plastic toys on the ground look great in a place, that's a good sign.
Oliver and Thomas, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Scaffold. I'm Matthew Blunderfield, and I produce the show. The theme music is composed and performed by Andrew Raworth of the band Stanley Park, with additional music this week by Tyler the Creator. Subscribe to Scaffold on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts, and follow the show on Twitter and Instagram at @scaffold_podcast. Thank you to Oliver Lutjens and Thomas Pedmanabin, and special thanks this week to Splice Studios and the Architecture Foundation. Thanks as always to Scandal Lynn, and thanks to you for listening. I'll see you again in 2 weeks.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.